Welcome to this portion of Vocal Point. I'm Jerry Newcomb, and right now we have a returning guest, Dr. Craig Evans, who is a professor at Houston Baptist University, and he's the author of the book Jesus and the Manuscripts. And we're going to talk right now about the subject of textual criticism. And the overall thrust of this is, can you trust the New Testament? And how does it stack, say, compared to other books of antiquity? Dr. Evans, thanks so much for joining us again.
Hey, you're very welcome, Jerry.
All right, opening question. Can we trust the New Testament, and how does it compare with other writings of antiquity?
Well, it compares very well. You can trust the New Testament because we have lots of manuscripts, a whole bunch of them, and a whole lot of them are very old. And that's how textual criticism works. If you have multiple copies, you can compare. If you only have one copy, that's it. You just cross your fingers and hope that it's accurate. Some of the mistakes are really obvious, where a scribe, he's getting dozy as he copies and he writes the same word twice or the same line twice. But what do you do if he leaves a line out and that's the only copy you have? You got a problem, because then you're trying to figure out what's left out. But with the New Testament, you have dozens of very old copies, hundreds of fairly old copies, and you can compare them. And scribes rarely make the same mistake. And so if you got a whole bunch of copies, you compare them, then you can readily identify where scribes made a mistake, slipped up, wrote the wrong word, or left the line out, or something like that. And so by comparing it, you can determine that, yep, here's the text, we've got it, and you read it, and it makes sense, then you have assurance that we really have recovered it the way it was originally written.
Okay, so sometimes we'll read in our Bible, and there'll be a footnote, and it'll say, well, some of the ancient manuscripts omit this particular verse. For example, for thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, now and forevermore, the tail end of the Lord's Prayer in Matthew 6. How are we to process that?
Well, that one's not too difficult. What it is sometimes liturgical elements, things used in worship, get expanded. We add another verse to a favorite song or something like that. And so adding a benediction or adding some kind of a concluding statement to a prayer is very common. So the Lord's Prayer was memorized and people would say it, and it would not be wrong at all to add an amen or, for yours is the glory and the power, to add statements like that, confessional statements. And what happened was, in the passage of time, an addition like that gets into the manuscript itself. And that's, we believe that's happened, because in our oldest copies of Matthew, Matthew chapter 6, where the Lord's Prayer is found, that final verse in a few of the very old copies isn't there. And so that's why you have these kinds of footnotes. There aren't very many of them, actually, but where it notes, and that's because we have rich manuscript tradition, we can say, well, these real old ones have this verse and some other old ones don't. And since it's more likely someone added it than somebody left it out, that's why the modern editions read and suggest that perhaps the last part of the verse is in a later edition.
Now, there's a modern-day skeptic, Bart Ehrman, and I know you disagree with him, and I do too, but he wrote a book called Misquoting Jesus. And in effect, this is kind of the long short of it. In effect, what he does is he says there's this, he never gives you the percentage, but this is about 1% to maybe 1%, maybe 2% at the most, of the New Testament that is questionable. And for the sake of that 2%, he throws out the other 98%, which is crazy. And again, if you were to compare the New Testament with other writings of antiquity, there's nowhere near you have a 98 to 99% rate of certainty. But let's deal with this if we could. The woman caught in adultery in John 8, is that a questionable passage? How does this work? How do we need to understand the veracity of that?
Well, it's questionable only in the sense that we're not sure that it was originally part of John. And we say that because our two oldest copies of John, which are very old, date to perhaps before the year 200, which is really old. In other words, the Gospel of John itself originally is hardly 100 years old. And that passage simply isn't there. In later New Testaments, in the Gospel of John, the passage is somewhere else. And in some New Testaments, a few of them, it's actually in the Gospel of Luke. So that tells us, okay, this passage probably does go back to Jesus, but probably wasn't in John when John was first written. And so it's one of those precious stories that a scribe understandably said, hey, we've got to get this into the gospel. I don't know how that got left out, but it belongs in the gospel. And so that's one of those examples where, you know, the addition probably is authentic. It's probably genuine, but it's not at all clear that it originated in the Gospel of John.
Okay, another text that Ehrman's aims his big guns at is in 1 John, where it kind of implies the Trinity. It has an entity of three, and you know you've got the Word and so forth, and the Spirit. But apparently, that's not in the original. Your thoughts?
Oh yeah, no, it's not in the original. This is one where the text. It's very likely not a liturgical text, but probably a homily where somebody in a confessional way has summed up the Trinity and then took advantage of the language that is original, is genuine in 1 John chapter 5, verses 7 and 8, and simply expanded it by inserting these extra words. And you can't find it in the Greek tradition prior to the Middle Ages. So it probably originated in Latin. And then it migrated from Latin translation on into the Greek.
So, but when we, you know, when we talk about this, it sort of makes me wonder, well, again, we go back to the top question, can we trust the New Testament, even in spite of these little, you know, changes here and there?
Well, of course we can. You know, we're talking about 20,000 lines of text, 27 different books, preserved in handwriting for hundreds and hundreds of years, long before a printing press comes along and you can mass produce them, you know, verbally exact. And the record of preservation is fantastic. And you mentioned, Jerry, at the top of the program that, you know, how's it compare to other writings? Well, very well. You know, we have classic works that are just famous, you know, philosophical stuff from Plato and Aristotle, historical stuff from Julius Caesar and so on, fantastic works that are very influential. And there are places where some of the text is lost and we don't know how it originally read. We just don't have enough manuscripts. We can't do a textual criticism at the level we can for the New Testament, so we're just left guessing as to what's missing or how it originally read. We don't have that with the New Testament. It's nothing like that. That's because we have so many ancient witnesses. And by the way, when, you know, Bart Ehrman says, you know, 1-2% or something like that, well, you know what he's really talking about is that when the New Testament manuscripts are handed down, the text gets glossed a little bit. And so when it says Jesus, somebody adds Christ or somebody adds Lord. Well, when you start doing that, and Jesus shows up a lot in the New Testament, God shows up a lot, and you start referring to God as God the Father, and every time Spirit shows up, you add holy. Well, that's how the manuscript tradition begins to expand a little bit. But the meaning hasn't been changed at all. And so nothing really is lost. It's just a question of a little bit of these additions here and there swelling the size of the manuscript a little bit. And so as we find older manuscripts, we don't have those additions. But it really has no impact on the meaning.
Huh. And spelling. There's a lot of spelling variations.
Oh, sure, of course, because there weren't any dictionaries, and so people spelled according to phonetics. And so the selection of vowels and diphthongs, that is where you have two vowels that make a sound, that's where you start seeing variations. But, you know, scholars know that. It's no big deal. And the Greek New Testament we use now is standardized. The spelling is all standardized. You know, words aren't spelled 2-3 different ways. But when you find the ancient manuscripts, you go back 1,500 years, 1,800 years, yeah, you do find spelling variations, but that's the way all manuscripts were in Latin and in Greek back in those days.
Well, you know, I would say then, I mean, I don't want to cast aspersion on anybody's character, but I would think that Dr. Ehrman then is dishonest because he presents the idea that you have all these hundreds and hundreds of variations within the Greek texts of the New Testament. But the vast majority of them just are involved in spelling differences and you know, the movable new, whatever that means. So in other words,
that's right.
It's almost like giving you the impression you really can't trust this book. And in reality, yeah, you can, you know, in its given context.
Well, yeah, I know. And that irks me. There are a lot of us are irked with Bart on that. There's a joke that there are two Bart Ehrmans. There's Bart Ehrman, the scholar, who does not do that. And then there's Bart Ehrman, the popular speaker and writer who deceives the gullible, uneducated public. And that's exactly right. In fact, if you know how to read, if you know textual criticism well and you read his book, Misquoting Jesus, the book refutes itself. He talks about all these things, all these changes, all these mistakes and so on. And then he chooses his best examples. Well, every single one of them is easily answered. And so if you actually know the stuff and you know the manuscripts and you know these readings and you go through his book, and it's just, oh, for Pete's sakes, there isn't anything here that actually proves what he's trying to show. And sometimes in his other books, he'll do that. He'll start off saying, oh, my goodness, Matthew reads this way, Luke reads this way. They can't both be right. Then he gets to the end of the book and says, well, other scholars know all of this, and they don't have any problem with it. So it's a little bit duplicitous, and it bothers me that he does that.
All right. Now, I understand when it comes to the Gospel of Matthew, there's something you want to say related to pride and place of the Gospel compared to the other three Gospels?
Well, you know, Matthew was the most popular Gospel by far. By the time we get into the second century, you know, the Gospels have been around for one generation. Well, we get into the second century, and everybody cites Matthew. Matthew is very popular, all the time quoted. Matthew gets appealed to just about as much as Mark and Luke and John combined.
Wow.
And so that's why I say Matthew had pride and place, and it stayed that way right on in until the modern period.
Wow, I never knew that. Is there still controversy about the Gospel of John, and if so, why?
Well, Gospel of John, if there's controversy, it'd be two things. One, it's just plain different. And so Matthew, Mark, and Luke, clearly they're moving along, covering the same ground. Jesus speaks the same way. He tells the same kinds of parables of the kingdom and so on. They're very Galilean up north in Galilee until Jesus goes south fatefully to Jerusalem, that final Passover. But in John, a whole lot of it is in the south. It's in Judea. It's in Samaria. It's in Jerusalem. There are three Passovers that are mentioned. Different content. Jesus speaks almost mystically, a lot of metaphor. I'm the good shepherd. I'm the light of the world. And he doesn't talk that way in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. So that bothered early church fathers. They wanted to know, why is John so different? And then, which John is this guy anyway? There was rumors there might be two fellows named John. And then what really, the second problem was that heretical groups liked John because they could really play with it. Gnostics liked John. You know, it's in John you've got the secret Jesus.
So they
claim. Jesus who teaches the really deep stuff. Hmm. Yeah, so that was why John had a rough time of it for a while.
All right. Well, we have about half a minute left. You want to recap our top story? Can you redo that statistic? I mean, re-explain that statistic about the 20,000 lines. I think that's pretty strong.
Well, it is. There are 20,000 lines, the way manuscripts were written in antiquity. So it would be 20,000 lines for the entire New Testament, all 27 books, 550 pages. As books would be written out by hand in antiquity. There are only 40 lines of those 20,000 where there's any uncertainty at all as to how the text originally read. And the uncertainty that we're talking about in these in these 40 lines don't touch on any important Christian teaching. Hmm. So in other words, you could choose whichever variant you want to. Choose any one. This reading, that reading, whatever. It has no impact. You don't have to think, oh my goodness, now I need to believe something different, or oops, that's it for the Trinity, or uh-oh. There's not one thing in those 40 lines where there actually is a question that impacts Christian belief in any significant way.
You know, I am so glad you're alive and you're out there doing this stuff, writing these books and saying this. I'm serious. I really appreciate you. Your website is craigaevans.com, the name of the book, Jesus and the Manuscripts. Dr. Craig Evans, thanks again for being with us.
You're very welcome, Jerry.
Okay, bye-bye.